Al Letson here, host of Reveal. Now, before we get started, something to think about. Today's show is all about impact, how our investigative reporting changes the world in very real ways. But to make that impact, we need your support. So listen, could you please consider a tax-deductible gift to keep the show going? By doing that, you'll be saying you think this kind of reporting matters. Donating will also make you a member of Reveal. And as a member, you get special stuff like this. Podcast extras, exclusive content, outtakes, a swag pack. You'll get free tickets to all of our live events, whether it's Reveal Live with me performing or Storyworks, which is plays based on our original reporting. So right now, please show your support by texting DONATE to 63735. Again, just text DONATE to 63735. Then follow the link to our website, revealnews.org/give. We want to thank you for downloading the episode. Thank you for your financial support. But more importantly, we want to thank you for just being amazing. That's right, because all of our listeners are amazing. And you, my friend, are one of those people. And now, on to this week's show. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Our reporting holds the powerful accountable and exposes government fraud, human rights violations, and environmental hazards. Sometimes that leads to changes in the law, corrupt people losing their jobs, and bad places getting shut down. We try to shine a bright light on injustice and protect the most vulnerable in our society. This episode, we're going to look back at some of our best reporting from 2017 and how that's made an impact. The story you're about to hear led to lawsuits, government investigations, and canceled contracts, stuff that's still playing out to this day. Let's hear a little bit from the investigation. It first aired in October.
Let's acknowledge the elephant in the room. Oklahoma's direct possession sentences haven't deterred substance abuse and have filled our prisons to overcapacity.
That's Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon. Her state reports some of the country's highest rates of substance abuse and incarceration. Last year, Fallon urged lawmakers to stop locking up so many people for drug-related crimes and start referring them to treatment and rehabilitation. And that's exactly what Oklahoma judges are starting to do, sometimes sending addicts to recovery centers instead of jail. Reveal's Amy Julia Harris and Shoshana Walter investigated one of those recovery centers. The place they looked at is called CARE, Christian Alcoholics and Addicts in Recovery. The founders of the program say it's all about helping alcoholics and addicts. Turns out, it also benefits a major chicken company.
Yeah, we love it out here. We have 80 acres and, you know, the men get out and walk.
The founder and CEO of CARE, Janet Wilkerson, shows Amy, Julia, and me around the program's Sunny Green campus. We walk along a gravel path past a rose garden, a flagpole, and into a gleaming dormitory. It's lunchtime.
Hey, guys.
How are you doing?
I'm good.
CARE is in a town called Jay, way out in the country, almost out of Oklahoma, in the northeast corner of the state. Almost 200 court-ordered drug addicts and alcoholics are here at any given time.
Janet says she wants these men to feel comfortable at CARE. Bible verses and her daughter's quilts decorate the walls. She thinks of her program as a ministry to society's outcasts.
I'm Mama Janet. I love to hug them and love on them because nobody likes them.
Court officials love Janet's program. CARE is strict and faith-based. It offers housing, meals, Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and counseling. And unlike most rehab programs, it doesn't charge its clients any money.
And that was one of the principal reasons that CARE was created as it is so that we can help more and more people that don't have the funds.
That attracted Aaron Snyder to the program. He's left it now. I meet him at his apartment about an hour north of Tulsa.
Julie Harris.
When Aaron's parents first drove him to the campus, he had been arrested for his fifth DUI, and he was addicted to pain pills.
As we're pulling up, I reach in my pocket and grab some Lortabs and some Clonopin and take my last handful of pills and get out and walk in the door and check myself in.
Aaron hoped a year at CARE would help him turn his life around.
And you find out real quick, you're going to go to work, you're going to work hard, you're going to work hard for at least 40 hours, for the rest of the time, you know, 40 hours a week for the rest of the year you're here.
Every day, men from the program work alongside paid employees at chicken processing plants right across the state line in Missouri and Arkansas. Simmons Foods owns the factories. It's a privately held company that takes in close to $1.5 billion a year. Simmons makes chicken products for KFC, Walmart, and PetSmart.
My job was to clean the room that they killed the chickens in, which had blood literally sealing the floor in it and chicken heads and stuff laying around in it.
Other men hung live chickens on a noisy, speeding conveyor belt, like this one in this industrial video. In refrigerated rooms, workers pulled out their guts, sorted the parts, and packaged them. The hours are long. The machinery and tools move fast and can cause injuries. Most Americans don't want these jobs, and care guys got the worst of them. Here's what three of the guys told us.
Oh, it's the most awful smell you ever. I mean, like, I wouldn't eat chicken for like 3 years after I come home. That's the nastiest place, the nastiest thing.
No one's ready for that coming in. It is horrible. I mean, because your muscles, your back, your knees, your body.
A lot of the care guys, they'll get treated like, you know, like they're scum or they're troublemakers.
More than chickens hung over their heads. If they were slow on the line or injured on the job, Simmons could fire them. The county drug courts that sent them to care could send them to prison. On top of that, the men in the program work for free. Simmons pays care in exchange for the labor. Janet says that money pays for the program. The workers get no wages.
That's ridiculous, man. That's not recovery. That's a slave camp.
Even under these conditions, Aaron got clean at care. He was one of the few who did. In 2014, care reported only a quarter of the men completed the program. But many of the men who did say it saved their lives. Janet doesn't dwell on success or failure, but on the reason she started the program. To serve men like her brother, who drank himself to death.
That stuck in the back of my mind that he wanted help so bad, but money was an obstacle. And that's where we are with so many of these men. Money is an obstacle. They don't have $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 to spend for a, you know, 30 or 45 day program. I mean, that was part of the goal, was to help men like my brother.
That wasn't her only goal. We discovered that when Janet started care a decade ago, she was a human resources executive in the poultry industry, and she moonlighted as a spokeswoman for Simmons Foods and other poultry companies.
After she had trouble filling the overnight shift at the chicken plants, Janet pitched her bosses an idea. What if she created a nonprofit that put addicts to work?
It was an easy sell. Simmons gets a cheap and captive labor force. It pays care a flat rate for each worker. If one of the care guys gets injured on the job, Simmons is not responsible for them.
Plus, the company can fire them for any reason, at any time, and it doesn't provide health care. That's different from the way Simmons treats its paid employees.
In her office, I asked Janet and Jim Lovell about that. He manages the care program.
Was care started in part to benefit Simmons?
No, absolutely not.
They partnered with us because they want to help the alcoholic and the addict. And providing them a job is helping them.
We are such a small portion of Simmons.
I mean, I know.
They're a big company. We have a, you know, a minute portion of their workforce.
And if 40 hours a week is a slave camp, then America's a slave camp, huh?
I know that compared to Simmons' entire workforce, care men are a very small portion of that. But they don't have to pay workers' compensation. They don't have to pay for other benefits. Care is taking care of that, right? Mm-hmm. So are there benefits to Simmons aside from their helping addicts and alcoholics?
I'm sure there is. We're like a temp agency, and they hire through lots of temp agencies. And, you know, so yeah, it's a benefit to them. We're providing workers. But I will tell you, the benefit to the men is much larger than the benefit that Simmons receiving.
There are big differences between the workers from care and most Americans. People who work 40 hours a week get paid for it. So do defendants at some other rehabs that require them to work. The care guys don't. When most Americans quit or get fired from their jobs, they don't risk prison time. The way Aaron sees it, the men lose and the program and company win.
Work takes priority over everything. If it's work or counseling or work or classes, it's work. You're going to work. You know, they're scratching each other's back, that's for sure.
After graduating from the program, he worked as a dorm manager at CARE for a while, but he grew disillusioned and eventually left. CARE's tax filings show that in 7 years, the program brought in more than $11 million, most from its contract with Simmons. Those filings also show CARE pays Janet about $112,000 a year to run the program. At any given time, the program houses a couple hundred men. Janet says that's hardly enough to run a factory. Hundreds of paid employees also work at Simmons. But during certain shifts, Aaron says the assembly line depends on CARE guys.
You're talking about a plant that runs a quarter of a million, processes a quarter of a million chickens a day. Some of those shifts, they were taking two or three 15-passenger vans full of people to the chicken plant. You're talking 40 guys on a shift going to work at a plant. If CARE didn't go in, they'd have to shut the plant down.
The chicken company has repeatedly laid off paid workers as it brought on more and more laborers from CARE. Simmons even paid for CARE to build a new dorm, saying it needed more workers from the program.
We called Simmons to ask about this. Spokesman Donnie Epp says the company partners with the program to help addicts, not the other way around.
Is Simmons relying on CARE to fill that labor shortage?
You know, our goal is probably less about, filling a labor shortage and more about finding the right people for the right jobs. And then also, you know, believing in kind of the mission of CARE and the impact that they're having in people's lives.
Just as Simmons relies on CARE, CARE relies on the criminal justice system. Drug courts supply a huge number of the men who land in that program. Here's how drug court works.
To avoid prison, defendants must enter a guilty plea.
The judges require them to get regular drug tests, attend Narcotics or Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and hold down steady jobs.
Judges also order defendants to complete addiction treatment. And if they fail, they can end up behind bars.
In the Stevens County Drug Court, Sharon Kane tells the judge where he should send defendants for treatment. She's a big believer in CARE, in part because there aren't enough affordable treatment programs.
We used to have beds at inpatient places that was total treatment. They've cut the funding now, so drug court does not have beds that are paid for.
People wait as long as 9 months for the beds the state does pay for. At CARE, there's no long wait list. It costs the courts and defendants nothing. The program sends addicts away from the people and places that supported their bad habits. That's why Sharon uses CARE.
Generally, when I send people to CARE, it's to break ties with somebody in this county. It's to get them used to getting up and going to a job. So it's about making them grow up.
There's just one problem, though. A pretty big one.
We found out it may be against the law for drug courts like Sharon's to send men to CARE for treatment. Drug courts are only supposed to do that using facilities the state inspects and certifies. Those places emphasize mental health and drug treatment over work. Their medical and counseling staffs are fully trained.
CARE offers some services, but the program has never been certified, and most of its staff are not licensed. Because of that, when things go wrong, defendants have little recourse. Oklahoma requires its Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services to monitor drug courts and rehab programs throughout the state. But it can't do much if judges are breaking the law. All it can do is pull that drug court's funding.
Sharon doesn't seem to worry about that.
It sounds like you don't interact much with the Department of Mental Health.
As little as possible. I do what I want to do. They don't mess with me. And I'm not saying that in a cocky way. They just know I'm going to do drug court the way I've always done it. If they come in here and start messing with us, the judge will shut drug court down.
At least 20 drug courts in Oklahoma send defendants to CARE. state law says drug courts must use certified treatment programs. Some drug court judges have found a way around that.
They don't say they're sending people with addictions for treatment. They say they're sending people there to give them work experience and stable housing.
But Sharon says you should look at the results, like Brandon Spurgeon. He was a defensive tackle on his high school football team before he went to work in the oil fields. There, he got addicted to meth. Sharon thought CARE could help him, even though it's not certified.
Brandon appreciated it. It made him grow up a little bit, too, which is good. Did y'all meet Brandon in person?
We did. When we showed up, he wasn't doing so well. He just had surgery. Brandon and CARE parted ways a couple of years ago.
He normally towers over 6 feet tall. His t-shirt reads, "Keep calm and date a big guy."
He's sitting in his parents' living room, slumped on a brown corduroy couch, chewing tobacco and grimacing in pain. His mom, Renee, asks if he's okay.
You need another pain pill?
Yeah, but if I do that, I'll be in her sleep.
Here's how Brandon got this way.
One night, he was working at the chicken plant when a metal door crashed down on his head. Almost 3 years later, slurring his words, he remembers how hard it knocked him out. There was blood everywhere.
Yeah, I know I laid up for about 10 minutes so I could stand back up. Everything, my whole shirt was covered in blood. My pants had overalls on. They were soaked through.
Right after he got hurt, doctors stapled up his head. Brandon says the accident damaged his spine. He suffered from dizziness and intense migraines.
They sent him back to work.
He went back to work before he did go back. Did you go back to the chicken ranch?
Yep.
Yeah, back to the chicken farm. He did go back to work there before they sent him home.
Brandon knew he needed more medical attention, but he says he was scared to leave, so he kept working. If he didn't, he could fail drug court and get sentenced to 15 years in prison. He got sober and graduated from drug court, but...
I wouldn't do it again. I'd rather go to prison than do that again.
Brandon says he'd rather go to prison than go back to CARE.
Today, he's in constant pain, and he can't hold down a full-time job. At 35 years old, Brandon depends on his mom and dad.
He has days that he just absolutely can't work. He's non-functional at times.
Renee, his mom, does give thanks that Brandon is clean and his drug charges were dismissed.
Scared straight, heart straight, maybe, I'm not sure. So I'm not gonna say that it didn't work.
Renee says CARE never apologized to Brandon for his injuries. The program pocketed his workers' compensation and that of other guys who got hurt. Renee is trying to make peace with all that.
And so even though we say, well, we didn't get this and we didn't get that, we have him. Sorry. We have him, but he came at a price.
Brandon's health and his independence.
That was Reveal's Shoshana Walter and Amy Julia Harris, who are joining me in the studio now. So I know the story is still unfolding, but what's happening with CARE right now?
CARE is being sued right and left, actually. They are the subject of three federal class action lawsuits from former defendants who were court-ordered into the program who are suing the rehab program for all of their lost wages and alleging that they were modern-day slaves.
Yeah, and also two government agencies are investigating them. There's the Oklahoma Department of Labor and the Arkansas Workers' Comp Commission. The commissioner there actually called it nothing short of modern-day slavery. And the Oklahoma Attorney General's office is also looking into the program.
And one of the largest courts, the Tulsa Drug Court that sends defendants to CARE, has also stopped sending guys to the program as they're doing their own internal investigation following our reporting.
You guys both interviewed lots of guys who have gone through this program. What's going on with them now?
Well, there are some guys that we talked to who got clean in the program and they're doing well now. But there are a lot of guys who got injured in the program or who relapsed after the program that we talked to. And, you know, they're now part of the lawsuits against CARE.
We had a bunch of people reach out to us who finished the CARE program or were sent to prison after being ordered to CARE, who said that
it was one of the worst experiences of their life, and have said that they're glad that scrutiny is being shown onto this program, because before they would complain to their probation officers, to the courts, and they said nothing happened. No one really cared what happened to them.
We actually heard from some Simmons employees who said they, you know, the guys in the program are not allowed to have phones. So there was one Simmons worker who actually read the story out loud to guys who are currently there from her phone. And so we know that the story is getting out there to guys who are still at CARE to this day.
So why are judges using programs like this?
There's a big push now in Oklahoma and all over the country to divert offenders from prison and into rehab programs. So drug courts in Oklahoma send a bunch of people to CARE. And what they've told us is that there's just a lack of affordable treatment programs in Oklahoma. The wait list for licensed places, it can be 9 months up to a year. There are a limited number of spots. So they often turn to these work-based programs that are quote-unquote free and always have an open bed.
How big is this? Are there other programs out there like CARE?
Yeah, there are programs like this all over the country. We're currently looking at a long list of about 50 programs going through TIPS. And we also just came out with a story about a similar program in Oklahoma started by a very celebrated drug court judge who's known for his criminal justice reform efforts. And he started his own program that forces people to work at a Coca-Cola bottling plant, at a pregnancy pillow manufacturer, a roofing company. The guys work these jobs full time and don't get paid for their work. And they also do, you know, the judge's yard work and other jobs on the side without getting paid.
And it's not just Oklahoma. We found that this is all over the country. Programs similar to this are also very popular in Arkansas. And we came out with a story that showed that politicians are even benefiting from this. The Arkansas Senate Majority Leader had a plastics factory that was staffing the factory with guys from another work-based rehab program, and those people were working for free. Since our reporting, he's since canceled his contract. It just shows that it's all over the place. It's politicians, judges are involved with this, and major corporations all over the country.
And I should also add, the Coca-Cola bottling plant has also suspended their relationship with the program because of our reporting.
Shoshana Walter and Amy Julia Harris, I know you guys are going to keep your eye on this. Please keep us informed.
We will. Thanks, Al.
Thanks, Al.
If you're like me, when you listen to that investigation, you may be feeling like, ah, what can I do? And the great place to start is with us at Reveal. We need your support. So please make a tax-deductible donation to Reveal. Just text the word DONATE to 63735. Again, that's DONATE to 63735. Your gift will make you a member. You can pick up some Reveal swag. You also get a peek behind the scenes here at the Reveal newsroom. And you'll get tickets to a live event. One more time, text the word DONATE to 63735 to become a member. Thanks for your support. And now, on to one of the biggest international scoops of the year. The Paradise Papers expose offshore tax shelters for the wealthy and big corporations.
And that includes everything from Apple to Facebook, Walmart, Uber, all the brands that are around us all the time. What we are seeing is really industrial scale tax avoidance.
That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. We're looking back at some of our most important stories from this year. And this next one is about a massive leak of documents called the Paradise Papers.
Good morning.
Last spring, more than 100 journalists crowded into a conference room in downtown Munich. They're inside a gleaming office building with a perfect view of the Alps.
Our technicians do tell us that there are still dozens of cell phones switched on. Please switch them off now. And it's really strict.
This is the home of Süddeutsche Zeitung, one of Germany's biggest newspapers. Outside of the people in this room, almost no one in the world is supposed to know what's going on here.
Basically encrypt every communication, every data you store on your computer, encrypt it and so protect it. And at the same time, shut up. Don't speak with people. Don't speak with colleagues in your media outlet that are not involved in the project, because this is a very sensitive area.
The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists convened these reporters from around the globe. The meeting was about millions of pages of leaked documents, exposing how some of the world's wealthiest people and corporations stashed their money in offshore tax havens. Reveal's Michael Montgomery was a part of the investigation, and we have him in the studio today. Hey, Michael.
Hey, yo.
All right, so I've seen estimates that there are trillions of dollars in these offshore accounts. Do we have any idea exactly how much money we're talking about?
Well, Al, the offshore industry is, of course, totally secretive by nature, so we don't know for sure. One estimate of Fortune 500 companies, those are U.S. corporations, puts about $2.6 trillion offshore. And if you're thinking about how much that could be in tax revenue, one estimate is that that amounts to about $100 billion a year in tax revenue that would otherwise be collected in the U.S. but isn't.
So who's keeping their money in these accounts?
Well, a lot of the accounts come from this company, Appleby. It's an offshore law firm that specializes in parking your money overseas. We saw the Queen of England's name pop up, Bono, a lot of political leaders from around the world. And in terms of the U.S., Wilbur Ross, he's President Donald Trump's Commerce Secretary. We learned through the leaks that Wilbur Ross had significant investments in a shipping company that does business with people very close to Russian President Vladimir Putin. And after becoming Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross retained these investments. And that raised a lot of ethical and even legal questions.
What happened after the Paradise Papers were published? Was there any blowback?
There was indeed, especially for Wilbur Ross. Once the story came out, he did indicate he would divest his shares in the shipping companies that he was invested in. These are the companies that do business with the Kremlin. Also, Democrats in Congress have called for an ethics investigation, but it's unclear what's going to happen.
So if the Paradise Papers show how big corporations move their money offshore, let's name names. I mean, who is doing this?
Big brands, Al. Uber, Apple, Nike. And they sort of play this international shell game with their cash. They move it from one place to another, Bermuda, Cayman Islands, the Netherlands, wherever they can find low tax rates. Now, they're going to tell you that there's a lot of other business reasons for doing this, but taxes are a big part of it. And it's interesting to know, Al, with tax reform, like lowering the corporate tax rate, lowering the repatriation rate, that's what companies pay to bring their money back to the U.S., it's really unclear whether that's going to address the problem. First, will companies bring their money back if they're still paying a lower rate or no rate in some of these offshore entities? And second, if the money does come back to the U.S., what will corporations do with it? Will they invest in jobs or will they simply buy back shares in order to raise their stock price?
Let's listen back to your story from earlier this year where you focused on Nike and Apple.
This chapter of Apple's offshore story starts just over 4 years ago, May 2013, Washington, D.C.
We pay all the taxes we owe, every single dollar.
Apple CEO Tim Cook assured U.S. senators his company goes fully by the book.
We not only comply with the laws, but we comply with the spirit of the laws. We don't depend on tax gimmicks. We don't move intellectual property offshore and use it to sell our products back to the United States to avoid taxes. We don't stash money on some Caribbean island. We don't move our money from our foreign subsidiaries to fund our U.S. business in order to skirt the repatriation tax.
So when Apple's name kept showing up in the Paradise Papers documents, Simon Bowers wanted to get to the core. He's another reporter with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. So Simon, Tim Cook, 2013, he is saying that Apple does not stash their money, quote, on a Caribbean island. True or not?
True at the time, yeah. Yeah.
What happens after that?
Well, an awful lot, really, because the revelations from the Senate committee caused huge ructions around the world in tax and investigations all over Europe.
At that time, the world learned Apple had been using subsidiaries in Ireland to avoid almost all taxes on money earned overseas.
Under pressure, the company agreed to change. To figure out how to change, the iPhone maker turned to Appleby, a law firm where many of the Paradise Papers come from.
What they wanted to know was, what would it be like if Apple were to have an Irish company that was quietly run from one of these islands? You know, Grand Cayman, Bermuda, Jersey, Guernsey. What would it be like?
Here's what happened.
We've also learned that after receiving the various feedback from Appleby, Apple did take two of its most important Irish companies to Jersey for tax residency.
Jersey is an island, but it's in the English Channel, not in the Caribbean.
It's a distinction in geography, but not really in tax. They're both sort of classic tax havens in terms of corporate income tax.
Simon found that overall, the tax rate Apple pays on the money it earns overseas remains extremely low, just over 4% on their overseas cash.
They've got about $250
billion. $250
billion. Yeah. I mean, an interesting comparison is, you know, the market value of the company is about $800 billion, right? And $250 of that is just cash.
Parked overseas.
Yeah.
There's another fascinating layer to this story. Think about all the things that make an iPhone so cool.
What it feels like in your hand, the usability of the product, and how it fits in with the rest of your Apple world.
Sure, it costs money to buy and assemble the hardware of the iPhone. That usually happens in a factory outside the US. But the real value of Apple's products is something you can't touch. It's the intellectual property, or IP, the creative process. And as Tim Cook told the Senate, all that happens here in the U.S.
You might be surprised to learn that much of that innovation takes place in a single U.S. zip code, 95014. That's Cupertino, California, where we have built an amazing team, the brightest, most creative people on the planet.
But all of those ideas, all of that intellectual property, it's very mobile. It can go anywhere.
Your intellectual property, you can sign it over to a company in anywhere in the world that suits you for tax purposes. So these are very, very mobile assets, and that makes them ideal for tax planners.
Apple is hardly alone. Nike does it too. Just like with Apple, Nike has one asset that's more valuable than all the plastic and fabric that goes into the shoes. She recognized me by my oversized Nike swoosh. She liked my swag and I'm trying to see. Yep, the Nike swoosh. The company's signature design element is the reason why their shoes are so valuable.
Nike's done something very clever. What they've done is they've separated out the swoosh and the other trademarks so that the trademarks are owned by different companies for different territories. So there'll be a company that owns the trademarks for the US. But there'll be another company, say in Bermuda, that owns a trademarks for the rest of the world, pretty much.
Simon says that when someone in, say, Spain buys a pair of Nikes, the full value of that intellectual property doesn't make it back to the U.S.
When the Spanish buyer of the sneakers buys those sneakers, the money trail from Spain gets stuck. It stops in Bermuda. And that is exactly where this tax planning process does its magic.
A couple of years ago, Nike moved overseas ownership of the swoosh to a Dutch offshore company. Nike has a much smaller pile of cash overseas than Apple, but it's still about $12 billion. Apple declined to answer questions about its offshore tax strategy. A spokesman said the company had informed regulators of its reorganization at the end of 2014, and the changes it made did not reduce tax payments in any country. Nike also declined to comment on specific questions. In a statement, the company said its tax filings are fully aligned with how the business is run. As for Appleby, the law firm at the center of the Paradise Papers, they told us they only advise clients on lawful ways to conduct their business, and they don't tolerate illegal activity. They also complained about reporters using material that may have been obtained illegally.
It is perfectly legitimate to use material that has been obtained by whistleblowers and then passed on to journalists.
Marina Walker Guevara is deputy director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists.
As long as the journalists have not participated in any illegal obtention of the material. And that is crystal clear in this case. And we have focused on issues of public importance and public interest.
The reporters who received the Paradise Papers aren't talking about their sources, but we know something about why people leaked the Panama Papers, the blockbuster investigation from last year.
Yeah, the sources of the Panama Papers, they call themselves John Doe. And to this day, we don't know if it is a Joan or a Jane or many people, but they wrote a very compelling manifesto a few days after we published the Panama Papers. And in that manifesto, they say that they wanted to expose to the world the intrinsic injustice of the offshore system. The first sentence of the manifesto is very telling, and it says this is the story of inequality, which is one of the most important and urgent stories of our time.
And you would say that applies also to this new investigation in terms of inequality?
Absolutely. This is chapter two of the inequality story, but at a much higher level, because we are now looking into a very rare window in which we can see the wealthiest and the most powerful members of our society, both individuals and corporations.
That story was produced by Reveal's Michael Montgomery. The Paradise Papers leak is all about holding government and people in power accountable. That's what we do every week on Reveal. If you like what you heard on today's show, please become a member of Reveal by making a tax-deductible donation. Just text the word DONATE to 63735. As a nonprofit, we rely on your donations to make our show. Again, just text the word DONATE to 63735. One of the most important issues we cover this year is the rise of hate groups, with violence sometimes spilling out onto the street.
You will not replace us! You will not replace us!
That's coming up after a short break. You're listening to Reveal. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Today, we're bringing you some of Reveal's standout stories from 2017. And one that's up next began when I got caught up in something completely unexpected. Let me explain. So, Reveal has been documenting the rise of hate crimes and hate groups throughout the year. I've interviewed white nationalist Richard Spencer about his hopes for a white ethnostate. We dug into the secret online chat rooms that white supremacists use to plan their rally in Charlottesville, which left one counter-protester dead. Our coverage of hate led us to the place we're going to end our show, right in the middle of a fight.
Stop! 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 Stop!
I was covering protests in downtown Berkeley. Thousands of people marching through the streets to demonstrate against a planned right-wing rally. It was a beautiful day, the sky was clear, kids with signs walked next to their parents, protesters danced and sang on an impromptu stage. It felt like a typical Berkeley protest, pretty peaceful, until it wasn't.
Joey!
Nazis out of Berkeley! Nazis out of Berkeley!
I'm here in peace!
Nazis out of Berkeley!
I'm here in peace!
You came to Berkeley to get all this attention!
I was following a crowd of people who were yelling at some right-wing activists and chasing them away. Now, out of the corner of my eye, I saw a middle-aged man with a video camera being attacked.
The first blow hit me on the head, and then it clicked. It's like, oh no, this is not going to be good. And then I remember getting hit a couple more times in the head and like people forcing me down. And then it was like, I just remember feeling the impact.
Five people dressed in black with masks on their faces brutally beat the man to the ground. They kicked, punched, and hit him with poles while he lay there in the fetal position.
I realized that I was in serious trouble, but I think even as they were, pummeling me and I was going down, like it was going through my head, it's like, I can't believe this is actually happening to me. I mean, I knew there was a risk.
All of this happened so quickly. I didn't know who he was, what he'd done, or why they jumped him. But in that moment, I thought, they're going to kill him.
Yeah, I was feeling everything, and I thought, this is it. I'm going to die. It's like they don't seem to be wanting to let up, and nobody's around. So, and then I think I said a quick prayer, and I thought, I hope this is quick because this really hurts, and I don't want this to go on another 5 minutes.
When I saw what was happening, I did something kind of crazy. I didn't really think about it. I just reacted. I ran over to help him. I pushed someone out of the way and dropped on top of the man, shielding him with my body. Time seemed to slow in that moment. I braced myself for a beating that never came. Others came over to break up the fight. The mob moved on. When it was over, I found myself sitting on a curb, adrenaline pumping through my blood, fog from a smoke grenade clouding my eyes, a crowd moving around me, and I wondered, how do we get here? And who was this guy that I protected?
I'm an artist, I'm a writer, amateur photographer. I spend a lot of time writing, and that's where I feel most at home.
It turns out his name is Keith Campbell. He's 54, lives in the Bay Area, and likes to wear American flag t-shirts. Keith says he's a journalist for conservative websites. Antifa, or the anti-fascist group that targeted him, accused Keith of using his camera to dox people. Now, doxing is when someone posts private information about you online, often with photos or videos. At the rally, Keith had his camera out and was filming the protests when he was jumped.
And, you know, then later seeing the video
stop
of what you did, and I couldn't believe it. And you didn't know who I was. For all I knew, you might have figured I was a Nazi or an alt-right or something, because that's kind of how we're painted in the media. But I still did that. I owe you my life.
Keith, I'll be honest with you, buddy. I've been looking at your Twitter feed, and there's a lot of things that I'm uncomfortable with. I actually interviewed some Antifa people who were at the rally. The person I spoke to, he says that you are on a hit list.
I know.
That they have a group of targets that they are going after.
I know.
And so their rationale for going after you is because they say that when you go to these rallies, you are there to primarily dox them, that you are there to tell people who they are, put all their information out. And, you know, a lot of things that I've seen online have said that for many months now, you've been harassing a lot of the people who are in the Antifa movement. And I'm curious, you know, what your thoughts are about that.
Yeah, sure. In regards to, you know, the whole doxing thing, yeah, I know people are saying that I would dox him. I've never tried to unmask any Antifa, and I would never try to unmask any Antifa.
Do you think that the Antifa are on par with the white supremacists?
Not as a whole, no. But I think there are people on the far left are probably equally as bad as the people on the far right. But I don't think that's the largest amount of people of them, no, on either side.
I'm looking at a tweet that you said, "Hey, Berkeley Antifa, you effing p***, accept the challenge. You're no good with your fists anyway." That was July 13th. On August 19th, this is before the event that happened, you got, "Why don't you p- come out to Berkeley and we'll talk about that. All of those statements are provocation. You're pushing. I don't think it's a long jump for me to go from reading these statements to seeing what happened to thinking that you went out there to stir it up.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what to say. I know I obviously said that stuff.
In tweets that you have here, I've got a bunch of them of you saying, you know, get the F out of America, Muslims, or renounce Islam. Not in my country. If you follow Islam, you don't belong in the U.S. That effing religion is a cancer to the world and has no place in the West. If you follow Islam, you need to go where it's practiced, not in the USA. So all of those things that you're saying there feed into the bigger ideas that Richard Spencer is pushing of a white ethnostate. And so, do you understand what I'm saying? Like, how those two things play together?
Yeah. No, I totally get it. And I think a white ethnostate would be horrible. And I don't think that people should be segregated at all. And Let me ask you this.
You're a member of the Oath Keepers. And you know, the Oath Keepers, as an organization, they say that they're really like all about the Constitution. The reason why I bring that up, because the First Amendment of the Constitution guarantees the freedom of religion. You know, so the part that I am unsure of with you is that if you're an Oath Keeper, you believe in the Constitution, you believe in the freedom of speech. That's a really important thing for you, correct? The freedom of speech.
Yes.
And so therefore, I'm curious if you believe in the First Amendment, the part where it talks about the guarantee of freedom of religion, because you don't get to pick and choose if that's the case. You don't get to say like, oh, it's freedom of religion for people who are of Christian denomination. That's not in the document. You don't get to say like, oh, it's freedom of religion for everybody except Islam. That's not in the document.
You're right.
Do you have any regrets about that?
Yeah, I do. I have a lot of regrets about, things I've said and I mean, who hasn't said stuff and later realized that they might have been wrong or at least shouldn't have said that? Or, you know, I think that's why it's good to talk to people who don't hold your beliefs. So you either learn that maybe your beliefs are correct and it strengthens you, or you learn that you're wrong, that you need to change or pivot and re-examine the beliefs that you have or the things that you value. And I'm not above changing or, you know, admitting I made mistakes and looking at things and looking at where I can, you know, change to become a better, different person.
Let me just say to you, man, that when I saw you on that ground, it wasn't the first thing that didn't come to my mind was that, oh, there's a white guy on the ground and he may be an alt-righter. He may be somebody that doesn't want me in this country. The first thing that I saw was a fellow American on the ground and he needed help. And that's why I went and helped you, because you are a human being and I value your humanity. And I would say that when I look at the statements that you've made, that you are taking a broad brush and painting everybody in a religion under the idea of maybe what a small group of bad people have done. And if I did the same thing, if I used the exact same reasoning, you might not be here today.
I think you're right.
Can you change, Keith?
Yeah.
Can you change the way you think and look at things?
Of course, as long as I'm alive, yes, of course.
Keith, I know that this was not an easy conversation to have, and I really appreciate you taking the time out to talk.
I knew it wouldn't be an easy one, so it's all right, I knew.
Tough conversations? Well, we're going to keep having them. And in 2018, we're going to dig even deeper, continuing our coverage of hate crimes, sexual harassment in the workplace, and climate change. Keep an ear out for those stories and a lot more in the new year. Today's updates were produced by Michael Schiller and edited by Brett Myers. Mwende Inaosa is our production manager. Our lead sound designer and engineer is Jim Briggs. He had help this week from Claire Mullen, Catherine Raimondo, and Kat Shuknit. Additional music and mixing this week from Ramteen Arablouei. Krista Scharfenberg is our acting CEO. Amy Powell is our editor-in-chief. Suzanne Reber is our executive editor. And our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Now, before I go, I want to give a shout out to all the people who work on Reveal that made it possible to be on the air every week in 2017. Our super producers, reporters, editors, our legal team, our data team, our sound designers and engineers, our administrative team, our interns, our fellows, the development team, and our board of directors. I also want to thank the 440 plus stations that carry us, our partners at news organizations around the world, and everyone that keeps us going. You know who you are, you know what you did for us, and we thank you for that. We also want to take a moment to say goodbye to one of the people who helped us get started. Our executive editor, Suzanne Reber, is leaving us. And Suzanne is a personal friend of mine. I met her actually the first time I came to the Center for Investigative Reporting to host the first pilot of Reveal. At that point, none of us really knew what we were doing. We just had an idea. We got into a really small studio that was actually a closet and started recording the first pilot that became this show. Suzanne has been there through thick and thin, and I personally am truly going to miss her. I remember during the first pilot, at the end of the show, I'd read the credits, and I came up with this tagline kind of on the spot that became the tagline for the show. And Suzanne was on the other side of the studio glass looking at me, and when I said it, she nodded her head and pointed at me and said, "That's it." So, for my friend Suzanne Reber, who I am sure we are going to work together again in some way, shape, form, or fashion, and to all of you who have listened to this show all year long, thank you, thank you, thank you. I'm Al Ledson, and remember, there is always more to the story. Okay, so I've said this like a million and one times already, but listen, it's that time of the year. We need your donation to keep going. We love you. You love us. Let's make it official. Just text DONATE to 63735. That's DONATE to 63735. If you do that, your gift will make you a member. You can pick up some Reveal swag. You also get a peek behind the scenes here at the Reveal newsroom. And you'll get tickets to a live event. One more time, text the word DONATE to 63735 to become a member. We want to thank you for downloading the episode. Thank you for your financial support. But more importantly, we want to thank you for just being amazing.